So the reading this morning is going to be from Ajahn Chah, from the Collected Teachings. This is quite sort of widely read piece called Unshakable Peace. And it's pretty lengthy. I won't get all the way through it, but we'll see how far I get. The whole reason for studying the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, is to search for a way to transcend suffering and attain peace and happiness. Whether we study physical or mental phenomena, the mind, citta, or its psychological factors, cittesika, it is only when we make the liberation from suffering our ultimate goal that we're on the right path, nothing less. Suffering has a cause and conditions for its existence. Please clearly understand that when the mind is still, it's in its natural, normal state. As soon as the mind moves, it becomes conditioned, sankhara. When the mind is attracted to something, it becomes conditioned. When aversion arises, it becomes conditioned. The desire to move here and there arises from conditioning. If our awareness doesn't keep pace with these mental proliferations as they occur, the mind will chase after them and be conditioned by them. Whenever the mind moves, at that moment, it becomes a conventional reality. So the Buddha taught us to contemplate these wavering conditions of the mind. When the mind moves, it becomes unstable and impermanent, anicca, unsatisfactory, dukkha, and cannot be taken as a self, anatta. These are the three universal characteristics of all conditioned phenomena. The Buddha taught us to observe and contemplate these movements of the mind. It's likewise with the teachings of dependent origination, paticca samuppada. Deluded understanding, avijja, is the cause and condition for the arising of volitional karmic formations, sankhara, which is the cause and condition for the arising of consciousness, vijnana, which is the cause and condition for the arising of mentality and materiality, nama and rupa, and so on, just as we've studied in the scriptures. The Buddha separated each link of the chains to make it easier to study. This is an accurate description of reality. But when this process actually occurs in real life, the scholars aren't able to keep up with what's happening. It's like falling from the top of a tree and crashing down to the ground below. We have no idea how many branches we've passed on the way down. Similarly, when the mind is suddenly hit by a mental impression, if it delights in it, then it flies off into a good mood. It considers it good without being aware of the change of conditions that led it there. The process takes place in accordance with what is outlined in the theory, but simultaneously it goes beyond the limits of that theory. There's nothing that announces, this is delusion. These are volitional karmic formations, and that is consciousness. The process doesn't give the scholars a chance to read out the list as it's happening. Although the Buddha analyzed and explained the sequence of mind moments in minute detail, to me it's more like falling out of a tree. As we come crashing down, there's no opportunity to estimate how many feet and inches we've fallen. What we do know is that when we've hit the ground with a thud, it hurts. The mind is the same. When it falls for something, what we're aware of is the pain. Where does all this suffering, pain, grief, and despair come from? It didn't come from the theory in a book. There isn't anywhere where the details of our suffering are written down. Our pain won't correspond exactly with the theory. But the two travel along the same road. So scholarship alone can't keep pace with the reality. That's why the Buddha taught us to cultivate clear knowing for ourselves. Whatever arises, arises in this knowing. When that which knows, knows in accordance with that truth, then the mind and its psychological factors are recognized as not ours. Ultimately, all these phenomena are to be discarded and thrown away as if they were rubbish. We shouldn't cling to or give them any meaning. The Buddha did not teach about the mind and its psychological factors so that we need attached to the concepts. His sole intention was that we would recognize them as impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self, and then let go, lay them aside, Be aware and know them as they arise. This mind has already been conditioned. It's been trained and conditioned to turn away and spin out from a state of pure awareness. As it spins, it creates conditioned phenomena which further influence the mind, and the proliferation carries on. The process gives birth to the good, the evil, and everything else under the sun. The Buddha taught to abandon it all. Initially, however, you have to familiarize yourself with the theory in order that you'll be able to abandon it all at a later stage. This is a natural process. The mind is just this way. Psychological factors are just this way. Take the Noble Eightfold Path, for example. When wisdom, panya, views things correctly with insight, this right view then leads to right intention, right speech, right action, and so on. This all involves psychological conditions that have arisen from that pure knowing awareness. This knowing is like a lantern shedding light on the path ahead on a dark night. If the knowing is right, if it's in accordance with the truth, it will pervade and illuminate each of the other steps on the path in turn. Whatever we experience, it all arises from within this knowing. If this mind didn't exist, the knowing would not exist either. All these are the phenomena of the mind. As the Buddha said, the mind is merely the mind. It is not a being, a person, a self, or yourself. It's neither us nor them. The Dhamma is simply the Dhamma. It is a natural, selfless process. It does not belong to us or anyone else. It's not anything. Whatever an individual experiences, it all falls within five fundamental categories: khanda, body, feeling, memory and perception, thoughts, and consciousness. The Buddha said to let it all go. Meditation is like a single stick of wood. Insight, vipassana, is one end of the stick, and serenity, samatha, the other. If we pick it up, does only one end come up, or do both? When anyone picks up a stick, both ends rise together. Which part of then is the vipassana, which is the samatha? Where does one end go and the other one begin? They are both the mind. As the mind becomes peaceful, initially the peace will arise from the serenity of samatha. We focus and unify the mind in states of meditative peace, samadhi. However, if this peace and stillness of samadhi fades away, suffering arises in its place. Why is that? Because the peace afforded by samatha meditation alone is based on attachment. This attachment can then be a cause of suffering. Serenity is not the end of the path. The Buddha saw from his own experiences that such peace of mind was not the ultimate. The causes underlying the process of existence, bhava, had not yet been brought to cessation, nirodha. The conditions for rebirth still existed. His spiritual work had not yet attained perfection. Why? Because there was still suffering. So based on that serenity of samatha, he proceeded to contemplate, investigate, and analyze the conditioned nature of reality until he was free of all attachments, even the attachment to serenity. Serenity is still part of the world of conditioned existence and conventional reality. Clinging to this type of peace is clinging to conventional reality, and as long as we cling, we will be mired in existence and rebirth. Delighting in the peace of samatha still leads to further existence and rebirth. Once the mind's restlessness and agitation calms down, one clings to the resultant peace. So the Buddha examined the causes and conditions underlying existence and rebirth. As long as he had not yet fully penetrated the matter and understood the truth, he continued to probe deeper and deeper with a peaceful mind, reflecting on how all things, peaceful or not, come into existence. His investigation forged ahead until it was clear to him that everything that comes into existence is like a lump of red-hot iron. The five categories of a being's experience, the khanda, are all a lump of red-hot iron. When a lump of iron is glowing red-hot, is there anywhere you can touch it without getting burnt? Is there anywhere at all that is cool? Try touching it on the top or the sides or underneath. Is there a single spot that can be found that's cool? Impossible. This searing lump of iron is entirely red hot. We can't even attach to serenity. If we identify with that peace, assuming that there is someone who is calm and serene, this reinforces the sense that there is an independent self or soul. This sense of self is part of conventional reality. Thinking, I'm peaceful, or I'm agitated, I'm good, I'm bad, I'm unhappy, I'm happy. We are caught in more existence and birth. It's more suffering. If our happiness vanishes, then we're unhappy instead. When our sorrow vanishes, then we're happy again. Caught in this endless cycle, we revolve repeatedly through heaven and hell. Before his enlightenment, the Buddha recognized this pattern in his own heart. He knew that the conditions for existence and rebirth had not yet ceased. His work was not yet finished. Focusing on life's conditionality, he contemplated in accordance with nature. Due to this cause, there is birth. Due to birth, there is death. And all this movement of coming and going. So the Buddha took up these themes for contemplation in order to understand the truth about the five khanda. Everything mental and physical, everything conceived and thought about, without exception, is conditioned. Once he knew this, he taught us to set it down. Once he knew this, he taught to abandon it all. He encouraged others to understand in accordance with this truth. If we don't, we'll suffer. We won't be able to let go of these things. However, once we do see the truth of the matter, we'll recognize how these things delude us. As the Buddha taught, the mind has no substance. It's not anything. The mind isn't born belonging to anyone. It doesn't die as anyone's. This mind is free, brilliantly radiant, and unentangled with any problems or issues. The reasons problems arise is because the mind is deluded by conditioned things, deluded by this misperception of self. So the Buddha taught us to observe this mind. In the beginning, what is there? There is truly nothing there. It doesn't arise with conditioned things, and it doesn't die with them. When the mind encounters something good, it doesn't change to become good. When the mind encounters something bad, it doesn't become bad as well. That's how it is when there's a clear insight into one's nature. There is understanding that this is essentially a substanceless state of affairs. The Buddha's insight saw it all as impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. He wants us to fully comprehend in the same way. The knowing then knows in accordance with truth. When it knows happiness or sorrow, it remains unmoved. The emotion of happiness is a form of birth. The tendency to become sad is a form of death. When there's death, there is birth, and what is born has to die. That which arises and passes away is caught in this unremitting cycle of becoming. Once the meditator's mind comes to this state of understanding, no doubt remains about whether there is further becoming and rebirth. There's no need to ask anyone. The Buddha comprehensively investigated conditioned phenomenon and was able to let it all go. The five khandhas were let go of, and the knowing carried on merely as an impartial observer of the process. If he experienced something positive, he didn't become positive along with it. He simply observed and remained aware. If he experienced something negative, he didn't become negative. And why was that? Because his mind had been cut free from such causes and conditions. He'd penetrated the truth. The conditions leading to rebirth no longer existed. This is the knowing that is certain and reliable. This is a mind that is truly at peace. This is what is not born, doesn't age, doesn't get sick, and doesn't die. This is neither cause nor effect, nor dependent on cause and effect. It is independent of the process of causal conditioning. The causes then cease with no conditioning remaining. The mind is above and beyond birth and death, above and beyond happiness and sorrow, above and beyond both good and evil. What can you say? It's beyond the limitations of language to describe it. All supporting conditions have ceased, and any attempts to describe it will merely lead to attachment. Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. I practiced Dhamma without knowing a great deal. I just knew that the path to liberation began with virtue, Sila. Virtue is the beautiful beginning of the path. The deep peace of Samadhi is the beautiful middle. Wisdom, Panya, is the beautiful end. Although they can be separated as three unique aspects of the training, as we look into them more and more deeply, these three qualities converge as one. To uphold virtue, you have to be wise. We usually advise people to develop ethical standards first by keeping the five precepts so that their virtue will become solid. However, the perfection of virtue takes a lot of wisdom. We have to consider our speech and actions and analyze their consequences. This is all the work of wisdom. We have to rely on our wisdom in order to cultivate virtue. According to the theory, virtue comes first, then samadhi, and then wisdom. But when I examined it, I found that wisdom is the foundation stone for every other aspect of the practice. In order to fully comprehend the consequences of what we say and do, especially the harmful consequences, we need to use wisdom to guide and supervise, to scrutinize the workings of cause and effect. This will purify our actions and speech. Once we become familiar with ethical and unethical behavior, we see the place to practice. We then abandon what's bad and cultivate what's good. We abandon what's wrong and cultivate what's right. This is virtue. As we do this, the heart becomes increasingly firm and steadfast. A steadfast and unwavering heart is free of apprehension, remorse, and confusion. Confusion concerning our actions and speech. This is samadhi. This stable unification of mind forms a secondary and more powerful source of energy in our Dhamma practice, allowing a deeper contemplation of the sights, sounds, etc. that we experience. Once the mind is established with firm and unwavering mindfulness and peace, we can engage in sustained inquiry into the reality of the body, feelings, perceptions, thought, consciousness, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, bodily sensations, and objects of mind. As they continually arise, we continually investigate with a sincere determination to not lose our mindfulness. Then we'll know what these things actually are. They come into existence following their own natural truth. As our understanding steadily grows, wisdom is born. Once there's clear comprehension of the way things truly are, our old perceptions are uprooted and our conceptual knowledge transforms into wisdom. That's how virtue, samadhi, and wisdom merge and function as one. As wisdom increases in strength and intrepidity, samadhi evolves to become increasingly firm. The more unshakable samadhi is, the more unshakable and all-encompassing virtue becomes. As virtue is perfected, it nurtures samadhi, and the additional strengthening of samadhi leads to a maturing of wisdom. These three aspects of the training mesh and intertwine. United, they form the Noble Eightfold Path, the way of the Buddha. Once virtue, samadhi, and wisdom reach their peak, this path has the power to eradicate those things which defile, kilesa, the mind's purity. When sensual desire comes up, when anger and delusion show their face, this path is the only thing capable of cutting them down in their tracks. The framework for Dhamma practice is the Four Noble Truths, suffering, dukkha, the origin of suffering, samudaya, the cessation of suffering, nirodha, and the path leading to the cessation of suffering, magga. This path consists of virtue, samadhi, and wisdom, the framework for training the heart. Their true meaning is not to be found in these words, but dwells in the depths of our hearts. That's what virtue, samadhi, and wisdom are like. They revolve continually. The Noble Eightfold Path will envelop any sight, sound, smell, taste, bodily sensation, or object of mind that arises. However, if the factors of the Eightfold Path are weak and timid, the defilements will possess our minds. If the Noble Path is strong and courageous, it will conquer and destroy the defilements. If the defilements are powerful and brave, while the path is feeble and frail, the defilements will conquer the path. They conquer our hearts. If the knowing isn't quick and nimble enough, as forms, feeling, perception, and thoughts are experienced, they possess and devastate us. The path and the defilements proceed in tandem. As Dhamma practice develops in the heart, these two forces have to battle it out at every step of the way. It's as though there are two people arguing inside the mind, but it's just the path of Dhamma and the defilements struggling to win domination of the heart. The path guides and fosters our ability to contemplate. As long as we are able to contemplate accurately, the defilements will be losing ground. But if we are shaky, whenever the defilements regroup and regain their strength, the path will be routed as defilements take its place. The two sides will continue to fight it out until eventually there is a victor and the whole affair is settled. If we focus our endeavor on developing the way of Dhamma, defilements will be gradually and persistently eradicated. Once fully cultivated, the Four Noble Truths reside in our hearts. Whatever form suffering takes, it always exists due to a cause. That's the Second Noble Truth. And what is its cause? Weak virtue, weak samadhi, weak wisdom. When the path isn't durable, the defilements dominate the mind. When they dominate, the Second Noble Truth comes into play, and it gives rise to all sorts of suffering. Once we are suffering, those qualities which are able to quell the suffering disappear. The conditions which give rise to the path are virtue, samadhi, and wisdom. When they have attained full strength, the path of Dhamma is unstoppable, advancing unceasingly to overcome the attachment and clinging that bring us so much anguish. Suffering can't arise because the path is destroying the defilements. It's at this point that cessation of suffering occurs. Why is the path able to bring about the cessation of suffering? Because virtue, samadhi, and wisdom are attaining their peak of perfection, and the path has gathered an unstoppable momentum. It all comes together right here. I would say for anyone who practices like this, theoretical ideas about the mind don't come into the picture. If the mind is liberated from these, then it is utterly dependable and certain. Now whatever path it takes, we don't have to goad it much to keep it going straight. Consider the leaves of a mango tree. What are they like? By examining just a single leaf, we know. Even if there are 10,000 of them, we know what all those other leaves are like. Just look at one leaf. The others are essentially the same. Similarly with the trunk. We only have to look and see the trunk of one mango tree to know the characteristics of them all. Just look at one tree. All the other mango trees will essentially be no different. Even if there were 100,000 of them, if I knew one, I'd know them all. This is what the Buddha taught. Virtue, samadhi, and wisdom constitute the path of the Buddha. But the way is not the essence of the Dhamma. The path isn't an end in itself, not the ultimate aim of the Blessed One. But it's the way leading inwards. It's just like how you traveled from Bangkok to my monastery, Wat Nong Pabong. It's not the road you were after. What you wanted was to reach the monastery, but you needed the road for the journey. The road you traveled on is not the monastery. It's just the way to get here. But if you want to arrive at the monastery, you have to follow the road. It's the same with virtue, samadhi, and wisdom. We could say they are not the essence of the Dhamma, but they are the road to arrive there. When virtue, samadhi, and wisdom have been mastered, The result is profound peace of mind. That's the destination. Once we've arrived at this peace, even if we hear a noise, the mind remains unruffled. Once we've reached this peace, there's nothing remaining to do. The Buddha taught to give it all up. Whatever happens, there's nothing to worry about. Then we truly, unquestionably know for ourselves. We no longer simply believe what other people say. The essential principle of Buddhism is empty of any phenomena. It's not contingent upon miraculous displays of psychic powers, paranormal abilities, or anything else mystical or bizarre. The Buddha did not emphasize the importance of these things. Such powers, however, do exist and may be possible to develop. But this facet of Dhamma is deluding, so the Buddha did not advocate or encourage it. The only people he praised were the ones who were able to liberate themselves from suffering. To accomplish this requires training, and the tools and equipment to get the job done are generosity, virtue, samadhi, and wisdom. We have to take them up and train with them. Together they form a path inclining inwards, and wisdom is the first step. This path cannot mature if the mind is encrusted with defilements. But if we are stout-hearted and strong, the path will eliminate these impurities. However, if it's the defilements that are stout-hearted and strong, they will destroy the path. Dhamma practice simply involves these two forces battling it out incessantly until the end of the road is reached. They engage in unremitting battle until the very end.
Does it say in the book or how do you remember where that desana was given? Or?
It was given at Wapaphong. It was actually given to a layperson who was a former Maha, so he had a degree in Pali studies, and then left the robes, and he was. He used to bring a group of lay people from Bangkok to support the support Wapaphong and also to support Ajahn Maha Amon, who was I think they knew each other when they were younger, so that. The actual talk was it probably the late 60s it was given, early 70s, probably late 60s, because it was actually one of the very first books in Thai that was done. There was one, before the, there wasn't much available of Ajahn Chah's. In Thai, but that was one of them. It was actually called The Keys to Meditation. And it was like a 3-hour talk or something. And Ajahn Maha Amon transcribed it and printed it, and it was one of the very first books that got people to know that Ajahn Chah existed. And then the English translation is kind of it's not the whole thing, but it's taken from that book Gujja Pavana. And a talk was given to this group and Maha, who was the head of that group. He came for many years to Wapaphong every year, once or twice a year, and brought people up to pay respects. I get tremendous respect for Ajahn Chah. I think that was, a lot of it was from this original talk that he gave, because it was kind of using the structures of the Bharati, of the scriptural study, explaining it in a way that was really practical, so really grab people's attention.
There are some like translations of like when Ajahn Jeff oftentimes will translate different Ajahns like Om Dhammaha Buddha. It comes across as like you kill the kilesas type of thing. And with this topic's more like the path is doing battle with the kilesas. Is that just the translator or is it?
Oh no, that's like Ajahn Chah.
It's Ajahn Chah.
That's Ajahn Chah. It's a that's his because it was I'd say back to back from yesterday's talk, it's actually quite I noticed that myself, for this guy it's quite striking. That's Ajahn Chah's way. I mean, he didn't really yeah, I mean, that was how he approached it and saw it, very much in grounded in that sense of these are dhammas that are functioning as opposed to personalities and personal entities. also, that when Ajahn Chah would use personal pronouns, he would oftentimes be we as opposed to you, sort of him up on the tamale, separating himself from others. And that was the flavor of Ajahn Chah's teaching. So that sense of strong sense of, these are functions of nature, functions of Dhamma that are playing themselves out. And obviously one has to pay attention to which side one's choosing. But it's not a big personal thing. And then Ajahn Chah rarely sort of separate himself out. He'd always sort of try to include people. So there's always, you always felt that he was kind of rooting for you.
Lumpur, I had for a while I was a little puzzled by this simile of like the stick that you pick up and you get both ends. Like you can't just pick up one part of the path. And kind of reading over this talk again, based on other stuff that's come into my mind over the last year or so, it seems like he's sort of responding or reacting a little bit to the widespread the inroads being made by like Mahasi Sayadaw method that's called Vipassana.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he's in effect he's kind of offering a critique of this way of approaching the path.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That you think that you can just grab the Vipassana part and get to the end really quick and discard virtue and discard samadhi.
Yes, yes.
But for a long time the way it was coming across to me when I would read Ajahn Chah was more like you can't do samadhi, you can't do Vipassana, all you can do is walk jagra, and do Buddha. The samadhi and Vipassana have to do themselves, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing for you to do except sort of just suffer until it happens.
It's in contradistinction to because it was very popular at that time, and especially in the circles of that maha, and say like Ajahn Maha, and he was mates with Ajahn Mahamala. Ajahn Mahamala, a lot of the monks were introduced to meditation through the Mahasi technique,
mm-hmm.
especially the study monks, because the forest tradition wasn't. that well known, and their access to meditation was quite limited, and it was introduced as this through the Mahasi technique, which was quite there's just this vipassana business. And it's also, and so there's a historical aspect to it. There's also, there is and it's not very prevalent now, but, if that talk was given over 40 years ago, and there still is to a certain degree, but it was a bit more well known. But there's a school of forest monks who really focused just on the samatha aspect, and just that there were basically, you've really got to perfect the samatha, and you've got to perfect the ability to gain the actual powers in order to be able to access the vipassana. And so that, on the other side of the coin, there's this strong separation of the samatha, and that you don't even deal with the reflection and insight aspect until you've really, at least fourth jhana, and really should have the whole mastery of all of the immaterial attainments, as well as some, at least some of the actual powers. So that's a long path. So the Ajahn Chah, I think, was quite radical at the time of saying, the way the mind is this works together. This isn't separate. Especially in terms of the application of the path and the integration of the path.
Is that the debate still being in Thailand? Because 20 years ago when I first went to Thailand, that was the very first Amitabha I ever heard of in Jayasaro.
Yeah.
He was kind of talking about, you can't do one without the other.
To a certain degree it's still there. I mean, it's, Buddhism has been arguing in camps for 2,500 years now. I mean, there's a sutta where the Buddha talks of the different groups of monks, and they tend to cast aspersions on each other. And it's even in the Buddha's time, starting to. I mean, it's human nature to align yourself with some kind of camp technique. Belief system, and of course create suffering. there is, I think it's not as strong. I think there is the influence of Ajahn Chah and many of the forest monks and many of the other monks who are or teachers who've been because it's also in the lay realm, there's a lot of very good lay teachers who've been have a broader approach to practice. So in the culture, for the Buddhist practice culture, there's a bit broader approach.
Found reflecting on yesterday's talk, I found very interesting is that at the beginning Ajahn Mongtam Mahabua said that he had been experimenting with lots of different practices, and then he found that didn't work, so he determined to stick to just do Budo 100%, stick with it whether it looked like it was working or not. And then later on, when he was working with the, that night when he was working with the pain, he seemed to immediately know that, he dealt with it once one way, and then he knew it's not going to work, the same thing's not going to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's, I mean, obviously that's a pretty insightful practitioner to be able to figure out when you need to do one thing and stick to it, and when you'll just completely fail if you do that.
Right.
But I was wondering if you had any reflections on how to discern when it's useful to, you know, just go for it, whether it works, looks like it's working or not. Just keep at it.
It's suffering. It's always the standard, in the sense of that you have to be reflecting and seeing, okay, what is it that's helping wholesome dhammas arise and maintain themselves, and what is it that's helping unwholesome dhammas to decrease or to head them off at the pass, sort of thing. So that there has to be that reflection, and that's always the standard that the Buddha gave in terms of, one, in terms of right effort, but then also in terms of what is it that accords with Dhamma. So that if a practice is not really according with Dhamma, then your unwholesome Dhammas will start to increase. And there's, you know, you have to pay attention to the flavor of the mind and say, okay, is there more clarity or less clarity? Is there more peace or less peace? Is there more brightness, more dumbness? Is there more happiness or suffering? So those are you have to be willing to tune into that and then make an assessment. Okay, this is starting to go in a particular direction. Now what do I do? Because oftentimes how we assess things, rather than experientially, we assess it from a kind of a idea or position. So if we take in the position, okay, I'm just going to stick with Bhutto, and I'm just going to annihilate everything through Bhutto, and incredible resolve. But then you sort of say, I am just hitting it out real hard with Bhutto, but it's not actually working. Okay, now what do I do? So then that kind of flexibility and adaptability is really part of the Dhamma practice, in terms of, you obviously have to start with some position or assumption or technique or method, but then you have to be willing to assess. And the assessment isn't through a self-position, you know, am I failing, am I succeeding, am I good at this, am I bad at that, because then that just keeps the mind churning. But is there, the position of Dhamma, in the sense of, is this according with Dhamma or not according with Dhamma? And then you're adjusting and adapting and tuning in. And a lot of the actual progress is oftentimes just the way that you tune in shifts the what you experience, how you experience it. So it's an important aspect of the, because the positions that we take are conditioning how we're going to experience things. And that's, if it's the position of, you know, kind of absolute and utter confidence, total belief in oneself, or worrying and fretting, or having all of these kind of positions that we take as a self,